Welcome to the Tuesday edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report and also to the My Ag Life and Citrus episode. In today's show, Taylor Chalstrom will bring us a report featuring the Citrus Research Board President Marcy Martin, who discusses results and feedback from the board's recent successful referendum. Kylie Harlan will then be in a little bit later on as she reports on the ag industry's response to rising labor costs. I'm Lori Boyer, and I'll have a look at regional and national agricultural news as well in the show today, beginning with regional ag news right after this word from our sponsor.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian Solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
According to the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service 2021 California Walnut Nursery Sales Report, combined sales of walnut trees to California growers were 6,444 acres for the 2021 crop year and 10,650 acres for the 2020 crop year. The majority of tree sales in 2021 were seedlings at 62% of new plantings. The Chandler variety came in second at 30%. For 2020, seedlings were the largest percentage of new plantings at 58%, with the Chandler variety coming out in second at 35%. The primary objective of the California Walnut Nursery Sales Report survey is to estimate planted acres by variety for the 2020 and 2021 crop years based on the number of walnut trees sold for new plantings. The report summarizes data supplied by California nurseries throughout the state who sold to walnut growers for commercial plantings. The California Department of Food and Agriculture is holding several public forums across the state seeking input from farmers, ranchers, and other stakeholders on priorities for the 2023 Farm Bill. The Farm Bill provides federal funding nationwide to support a variety of food and agricultural programs, including crop insurance, conservation, nutrition, and trade, and it ensures a robust farm safety net, promotes farming and ranching practices that are environmentally sound, and provides important nutritional funding for Americans. California Farm Bill listening sessions will be held on August 10th with a virtual session from 9 to 11. There is a Spanish translation provided. A live/virtual hybrid session on August 16th from 12 to 2 p.m. at the Neighborhood House in San Diego. Also, a Spanish translation will be provided. A live-only session on August 23rd from 12 to 2 p.m. at the Fresno County Farm Bureau. And a live-only session on September 7th from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. at the Urban Tilth, which is the North Richmond Farm. The Farm Bill listening sessions are a public forum allowing individuals input on California priorities for the upcoming Farm Bill. Comments will be used to help develop recommendations that will be shared with California's congressional delegation and the leadership of the Senate and House Agriculture Committees. Public comments are also accepted via email at farmbill@cdfa.ca.gov. For more information on any of the listening sessions mentioned, contact the California Department of Food and Agriculture. International Fresh Produce Association's Food Service Conference is coming up July 28th and 29th in Monterey. This year's event will see a record number of buyers attending, a sign of the strong appetite for putting produce on a plate at food service outlets. The conference attracts attendees from across the food service supply chain, including growers, shippers and processors, transportation companies, technology providers, and packing solutions. This year's event is shaping up to have a record buyer attendance with 800 buyer attendees, including food service operators, food service distributors and wholesalers, chefs, menu developers, and more. The event will also welcome any new audience of menu planners and food service directors from several of the nation's largest K-12 school districts. Pinnacle Fresh have been developing the Dracula citrus brand for quite a few years now. It started around 6 years ago with Dracula Blood Oranges going to the U.S. for the Halloween season. Since that time, it has grown into a whole Dracula citrus family, going to many markets around the globe. The Dracula brand really took off in the U.S. with Blood Oranges, and after a couple of years, they added mandarins, and at the request of retailers since then, they have introduced Cara Cara, Navel Oranges, Tangelo, and Lemons to the brand. That according to Daniel Newport from Pinnacle Fresh. The U.S. remains the biggest market for the brand, but Pinnacle Fresh have started selling in Australia, the U.K., Germany, Canada, New Zealand, and throughout Asia. They are about halfway through the navel season, and it has been quite challenging in terms of quality and sizing, which is putting pressure on the volumes of premium fruit. They will export less navels under the Dracula brand to the U.S. this season due to those issues, but with the extremely high shipping costs and long voyages, it's not such a bad thing. And there's good news on the horizon. Dracula Blood Oranges and Dracula Baby Mandarins are two of their most important members of the family, and they are looking very promising on quality and volumes. Harvest has just started on both varieties, and they plan to increase volumes on both these varieties, breaking their 2020 record for volume exported, according to Newport. According to Bill Goldfield, Dole Foods Director of Corporate Communications, he says that Dole Food Company is now a year-round supplier of grapes with production in Mexico, California, Peru, and Chile. The process started in South America with Dole reviewing more than 20 new grape varieties before deciding which would make the final cut. Shelf life, longevity, flavor, and appearance were the main factors that the company used in making its decisions. He said they spent years of research and planning to select the suitable varieties and farmers to partner with that they are confident would provide their customers with a consistent crunch and flavor experience. They then used this analysis in their selection process to ensure that they chose the best quality grapes that consumers would love. Choosing the grapes that have the best flavor, shelf life, and appearance is just part of the larger process of getting fruit into the hands of consumers, according to Goldfield. Optimizing a product for retailers is a constant work in progress, and emphasizing the power of the Dole brand is central to those efforts. Citrus growers and affiliates are invited and encouraged to attend one of the upcoming Citrus Pest Management Field Day events in Southern California, hosted by the University of California, at the Citrus State Park in Riverside County on August 4th, or at the Rancho Quijito Vineyard in San Pascal, San Diego County on August 11th. These free events do require registration to attend. To register, go to citrusinsider.org.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, supporting the industry with on-farm innovation through production research, advocacy for government programs, and driving consumer demand. Doing more together.
Taylor Chalstrom joins us next with the Maya Ag Life and Citrus Report.
California citrus growers voted to continue their support of the Citrus Research Board by a broad margin in a state-mandated referendum. The just-concluded referendum, which must be held every 5 years, was conducted by the California Department of Food and Agriculture. Citrus Research Board President Marcy Martin has more on those numbers.
We had about a 60% turnout of ballots from all of the growers who are confirmed to be commercial growers under the marketing order statute. And we had 99.5% in total volume, representing in favor of continuation. So that tells me that of all of the cartons that were those growers represented, the 60%, 99.5% voted in support. So that is a resounding vote of confidence in terms of those people who responded. But when I was driving home, I thought of it a little bit differently, and I think why. We take it with grace, and we are very appreciative of this kind of vote of confidence, is because when growers are confronted with voting for something that they have to fund, it's mandatory funding, they're looking at it from the perspective of all things that they're confronted with, not just the things that CRB can do for them or do on their behalf, or how they invest their funds. And there are things that the industry is confronted with today that the Citrus Research Board, even if they wanted to, could not work to resolve or address an issue or a concern. And so I think that's really meaningful because there is a lot that's going on in the environment today that would, that continues to make people be more conservative and the decisions they're making, particularly when the piece of the pie is becoming much smaller. And of course, disposable income is shrinking. Returns aren't increasing just because costs are. So again, we take it with a great deal of pride and grace And we know that how hard the board has worked on behalf of their constituents. And of course, the staff works in response to what the board directs them. And so we're very, very pleased. But I wouldn't be honest if I didn't tell you it's good to have it behind us now. So we don't have to worry about this. We just need to put our nose to the grindstone and keep our eyes set on the path that we've developed and move forward and talk about this again in 2027.
While the California Citrus Research Board is pleased to once again receive the support of the industry, Martin said that the board knows that they have to continuously improve upon their services and scientific pillars that allow the California citrus industry to thrive.
That's very important because, you know, research is outcome-based. It should be. That is, the need of or the result is determined kind of ahead of the time. And so we know the areas for which the Citrus Research Board is focusing. They're focusing on clean plant material and pest management, developing new varieties, production and post-harvest issues. But in terms of hearing what growers may expect over the next 5 years, the Citrus Research Board determined that this year we would be developing a grower survey because we want to seek input on the existing priorities or the priorities that the board is developing on behalf of the growers in the districts they represent. We want to request feedback from the grower base to capture the current challenges to serve as a method to guide us for future decisions, meaning how are the priorities defined? And does it look like the priorities we have, there's a clear purpose? Does it meet the need? Does it have an applied lens to the benefit of growers? You know, and can you identify that we have a mix of both short and long-term priorities? That's actually going to be going out this week. We waited for the referendum and then have this grower survey that we're going to ask growers to spend a few minutes to complete so that we can make sure that the priorities that we've identified align with the issues that our growers are confronted with, but also it serves to ensure that we haven't missed something, that there's not something out there that there's a technical need or a scientific need to resolve an issue that we just haven't thought about. So that's really important, and that's how we're going to address what our growers want to say, even though decades ago they've identified the disciplines in which we're going to operate in, scientific disciplines, but the issues we need to make sure are relevant to what people are currently experiencing.
Additionally, the board takes steps to address research priorities established decades ago to see if they're still relevant. The last assessment was in 2020, and it let the research board know where their priorities and challenges lie.
When we met in 2022 earlier this year, we really did take a look again to see, you know, from a 2 year to 5 year window, have we identified the right things that we need to invest in? And we wanted to make sure that they would align with future direction. And that included just improving our own internal process in terms of research solicitation and evaluating research proposals and terminating projects that aren't going to provide you the information in the time period for which you anticipated a need, and learning to move on from something and not just continuing to research something for research sake. You know, and we narrowed the priorities to what we think would be a real attainable goal. And we're also working a little bit more outwardly to encourage researchers to collaborate with other researchers, meaning maximize on funding that's available within other citrus programs, meaning at the federal level, and that we're not duplicating research efforts that other citrus organizations are also funding, such as in Florida or Texas. So I'd say the challenges would continue to be labor shortage and cost, water scarcity and regulations, invasive plant pests and disease, and mechanization or automation in the field, and continuing it with food safety. So based on that, I mean, again, we know what we're able to accomplish, or we know the arena that we're able to operate in. And there's not going to, we're not going to write immigration policy for sure, but we can do things that can address some of those challenges that we have. And that is including funding for research in water efficiency, efficacy, and or efficiency rather, and advocacy and partnerships with citrus organizations or other organizations that are also working on similar issues with water constraints or water regulations. Really looking for, to make sure that our portfolio includes farm-focused research and continuing the efforts to address ACP, which is Asian citrus psyllid, and HLB, Wan Long Bing, because we need to continue doing that, just as the other states that are doing that research. But also remembering that we need to monitor topics that, or identify topics that we might need to monitor for future need, but don't necessarily require us to invest in funding for research right now. I want to just tell anyone who's a citrus grower that hopefully listens to this that we thank them. We really do. And do not hesitate to reach out to us. We'd really like the feedback.
This is Taylor Chalstrom reporting for My Ag Life.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
The U.S. will be looking for proof that Russia is upholding its end of a Turkish brokered deal to free up Ukrainian grain exports. The agreement, if kept, could end at least partially a months-long Russian blockade of ports that remained under Ukraine's control, especially at the port of Odessa. State Department spokesman Ned Price.
To date, Russia has weaponized food during this conflict. They have destroyed agricultural facilities. They prevented millions of tons of Ukrainian grain from getting to those who need it. As I said, we welcome the announcement of this agreement in principle.
But more importantly,
what we're focusing on now is holding Russia accountable for implementing this agreement and for enabling Ukrainian grain to get to world markets. It has been far too long that Russia has enacted this blockade. It is a reflection of Russia's wanton disregard for lives and livelihoods, not only in the region, but well beyond.
Russia's blocked Ukraine from exporting some 20 million tons of stored grain, driving up world prices and threatening mass starvation in sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and parts of Asia. Growth in U.S. milk production is being constrained by several factors. USDA Ag News reporter Gary Crawford.
U.S. milk production this year may end up very slightly below last year and certainly lower than had been projected a month ago. USDA reporting that milk production during the April, May, and June quarter was 57.9 billion pounds, 0.5% lower than the same quarter a year ago. Part of that due to a dairy herd that was 87,000 head smaller than the April through June quarter last year. Some of it also may be slower growth in milk per cow than was expected. USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Chekanowski says that's the main reason that his board reduced its previous forecasts for production this year. He says there are several factors that will dampen the growth in milk per cow.
High feed costs, continued drought in the West, and heat stress, many factors that go into reducing milk per cow.
Or at least reducing the rate of growth. So far, we've seen increases in milk per cow in 4 out of the first 6 months of 2022. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Consumer advocates claim that John Deere may be violating the Clean Air Act by limiting repairs on the emission control systems of its machines. Such repairs are only authorized to certified John Deere dealers. Politico says the Clean Air Act requires companies to provide the necessary information, including software, to repair emission control systems in vehicles. Companies are required to confirm they're providing the information and certification filings with the Environmental Protection Agency every year. The advocates claim that by denying the necessary parts and information, the tractor manufacturer is violating the law. However, the company has said they restrict access to emissions control systems because farmers could delete software, which Deere says would also be a violation of the Clean Air Act. Deere says when emission systems break down, farmers might view deletion as an easier option. Deere is named in 17 class action lawsuits over repairs. The USDA has announced an increase in funding to help schools continue to serve healthy meals this coming school year and provided financial relief for schools and child care providers. The reimbursement schools will get for each meal served will increase by 68 cents per free or reduced price lunch and 32 cents per free or reduced price breakfast. The increase supports school and child care providers dealing with rising food costs. The boost in reimbursements will help provide financial relief for schools so they can continue serving high-quality meals to students amid higher food costs and continuing supply chain challenges, according to Stacy Dean, Deputy Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services. She says USDA is fully committed to using every resource in its tool belt to ensure kids get the healthy meals they need to grow, learn, and thrive. The USDA will provide an additional $2 billion for schools to purchase domestic food for their meal programs. The American Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture is working on a new mobile phone application that will put agriculture at America's fingertips. Farm News reporter Chad Smith has more on the American Farm Trail app.
The American Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture is working on developing the American Farm Trail app. Daniel Malloy, executive director of the foundation, says the mobile app will automatically connect users with agricultural venues that welcome visitors.
These could be farms that rely on agritourism, like Pick Your Own or You Pick operations, apple orchards, berry farms, or farms that host school field trips or interested families, people who just want to learn about and experience agriculture firsthand. We'll be linking the foundation's educational resources in the app so that the user can go to an apple orchard and link to our resources that are all about apples so they can learn even more.
The application will be geolocated so users can open it up to find venues that are close to them. Any farm or agritourism venue that welcomes visitors should submit their information for this app.
It's free for the farms and agritourism venues, so we make that easy. Plus, each farm on the app gets to control their own content, how they describe their site and their hours of operation. We're working on making it as easy as possible for that content to be entered.
Malloy says signing up for the American Farm Trail app will be a simple process.
We know that farmers are busy and there's never enough time in the day, so ease of use is important for us. But any farm or agritourism venue that wants to get people onto their farm should definitely register for the app.
To register, go to farmtrailapp.com. Chad Smith, Washington.
Thank you, Chad. Be sure to join us for Walnut Wednesday tomorrow here on the My Ag Life Daily News Report.
The Crop Consultant Conference returns on September 28th and 29th in Visalia, California. Co-hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors Association, this two-day conference features two concurrent CE tracks for both PCAs and CCAs. Earn the DPR and CCA credits you need. Network on our trade show floor and join us in giving away scholarships and honorariums presented by Western Region CCA, including the CCA of the Year Award. Take advantage of early bird pricing for only $175. Price goes up after July 31st. Visit progressivecrop.com/conference.
Kylie Harlan is up next as she talks about the ag industry's response to rising labor costs.
Agricultural labor costs are continuing to rise, particularly for producers in certain fruit and vegetable industries. Philip Martin, professor of agricultural and resource economics at the University of California at Davis, recently co-authored a report concerning how agriculture is responding to the rising labor costs. He brings us more details on the background of this issue.
Traditionally, average hourly earnings in agriculture had been 50% or one half as much as average hourly earnings in the non-farm economy. So for a non-supervisory production worker in 2020, the average hourly earnings in the non-farm economy were about $25. And at 50% for agriculture, that would have been $12.50 in agriculture. But in actuality, the agricultural average hourly earnings were about $15. So unlike the tradition that goes 50 years of having average hourly earnings in agriculture be half of average hourly earnings in the non-farm economy, they're now 60% and still rising more rapidly. So my projections are that average hourly earnings in agriculture are going to be $20 an hour, while they're $30 an hour in a non-farm economy sometime between 2025 and 2030. So that would be 67%. And that's the highest we have since data have been collected going back to World War II. So the short answer is the farm labor costs are rising faster than non-farm labor costs. And that has not often happened.
Through their research, Martin and his colleagues found three techniques producers are using to adjust to rising farm labor costs.
There are three basic responses. One is labor-saving mechanization, and that's the history of U.S. and global agriculture. Figure out how to produce commodities with fewer hours of work. And there is a new effort to mechanize. And what the study does is explain that mechanization in agriculture is not simply hauling a machine out of a shed and putting it in the field. It often requires changes in the plants to get them the crop to ripen uniformly, maybe changing the trellising of trees so that they're two-dimensional, more like a vine in a grape vineyard for an apple tree rather than a round tree, and then lots of progress in electronics so that machines can be durable and cheap and be able to select and pick apples. So there's a whole lot of biological and engineering challenges to mechanization. And what's happening is there's a lot more of that research going on. It tends to be more privately funded rather than publicly funded. And what that means is that the private companies are looking for the biggest market. So we see a lot more labor-saving mechanization, for example, on how to thin and weed crops, because that's applicable across a whole lot of commodities, and much less, for example, to develop a machine to harvest asparagus or to harvest cantaloupes, because even if you were successful in developing such a machine, the technical challenges are difficult. The acreage is so small, you wouldn't be able to sell very many of them. So the first thing is labor-saving mechanization. The second is to import workers, more workers from other countries. We have a program in the United States called the H-2A Guest Worker Program. The number of jobs certified by the Department of Labor to be filled has roughly tripled in the last decade. This year will be at about 350,000. And that's roughly, the H-2A workers are in the U.S. about half of the year. So it's pushing 20% of the jobs in U.S. crop agriculture, one out of five, being filled by H-2A workers. On the one hand, H-2A workers are more expensive because they have to be paid a special minimum wage called the adverse effect wage rate and be provided with housing at no charge. On the other hand, they tend to be younger and more productive. They pick faster, work harder, and there's no Social Security or unemployment insurance tax due on their wages. So that partially offsets some of it. So we have mechanization, we have H-2A guest workers, and the third is changing crops. Stop growing raisins and instead grow almonds because the almonds are easier to mechanize and our imports of labor-intensive fruits and vegetables are rising. So we get 90% of our avocados are imported, over 90% of our green onions, and a rising share of asparagus and many other commodities that are labor-intensive are being imported from other countries.
Martin said he and his team looked at a few specific case studies and commodities throughout their research.
Well, the USDA publication, there's actually two publications. The first one outlines the mechanization, guest worker, and import responses to rising labor costs. The second looks at, in some detail, at how those changes are occurring in, I think, four fruits and three vegetables. We looked at apples and strawberries and lettuce and tomatoes and a few others. And that gives you a hierarchy of how things are going to adjust, because each commodity faces different machine challenges, faces different guest worker challenges, and faces different import challenges. For example, there's relatively little import pressure on fresh apples. So the United States will continue to be a major producer and exporter of fresh apples. And so there the effort is to use H-2A guest workers as a bridge to more complete mechanization. It takes time to replant the orchards and to perfect the machines. On the other hand, there's a commodity like open field tomatoes, fresh tomatoes. And there we already import 60% of the fresh tomatoes, mostly from Mexico, a few from Canada. And that industry has been shrinking. It will probably continue to shrink. That land now devoted to fresh tomatoes will probably shift into something, another commodity, in especially in California and Florida, the two states that dominate fresh tomato production. So if we look at, we look across the spectrum of commodities, some are clearly on a path to mechanization, like blueberries. Some, it's really hard to see how there's going to be a mechanization alternative in the near term, cantaloupes, mature green tomatoes. And some are kind of in the middle. I mean, something like iceberg lettuce and romaine lettuce. These are commodities where there's already a lot of guest workers, a lot of mechanical aids, but there's still more research being done and more innovations happening to save on pre-harvest labor.
This is Kylie Harlan reporting for My Ag Life.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.